This is the Living Legacy Project interview with William Cooper on December 5th, 2013. William, thank you so much for joining me today and showing me your studio.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So we were just having a really great conversation before the recorder was on, mm-hmm. and I'd like to ask you to continue a little bit about it and tell me about your inquisitive nature as a child. If you want to keep talking about it, we were talking about how you always had to make up your own answers.
Make up my own answers to things. I had to have answers, and if people couldn't answer them, I'd make up my answers. You know, like the why does it rain, the hydrant outside, that God had a bigger one up in the heavens. I tell you what, another one, I love movies, even when I was 5 and 6, and I could go to movies by myself, because I have 2 buses I had to catch, so I could do that. I remember I went to a movie, and at this movie, they had these with popcorn. Everybody liked popcorn. They called them jumbo bags. They were so big, you know, and after the movie, I'd be walking along, going to catch my bus. And I'm glancing at the store windows, so something caught my eye. The 7 signs of cancer. I thought it was SANSA at that time. And I stopped to read it. I said, wow. One of the first ones was difficulty swallowing. And I sat there, I said, trying to swallow it. I thought I was having difficulty. And it really scared me. And I thought, I don't remember what the second sign was, but I had it, whatever it was. And I was really afraid. So I couldn't wait to get home to tell my mother, surprise, Mom, I have cancer. Well, what do you mean you have cancer? You don't have cancer. Yes, I do. I was looking in the store window and I was eating popcorn. What were you eating? I said, I was eating popcorn. And they said, you have trouble swallowing. And she said, well, I guess you do. You got your mouth full of popcorn. I said, I don't think it was that, Mom. And there were some more signs that I thought I had. And I said, you don't love me. Boy, we all love you. Well, you don't love me because you don't believe I have cancer. Well, that went on until she ignored me long enough for me to kind of get that out of my mind. But that's how I was. I would look at something and I see how I relate to it. You know, I was superstitious too. I'm not superstitious anymore, but I was a superstitious little kid. Somebody told me about a superstition. I had to check it out. I remember one of my friends, we were sitting on the curb, you know, talking, little buddies, I guess it was about, then I was about 7. And he said, we looked up and the funeral procession was coming by. And I pointed at it. I said, look, there's a funeral. He said, you know, that's bad luck. I said, what do you mean bad luck? It's bad luck to point at a funeral procession. I said, it is. What's going to happen to me now? Well, you have to stick your finger in the ground until the procession passes. Well, okay, that's no big deal. I stuck my finger in the ground. And guess what? There was a church in the middle of the block. That's where the funeral was going. And it stopped. So now, what do I do now? I have to keep my finger in the ground. Anyway, to make it short, it was crazy. It was in the evening, of course, and my buddy said, I'm going home. I said, I want to leave too. You can't leave. The funeral procession stopped at the church, and you can still see it. And I stayed there until my finger in the ground, until it was night. Believe me, I felt stupid, but I didn't know why I was feeling stupid. I thought maybe what he said was true. So I wanted to know things, and sometimes when I found out about them, they would be rather scary. But I just had to have answers to these kinds of things. I'll give you one more example because it's kind of silly. One day it was raining lightly, and I'm in my backyard, and another friend of mine came by, and he said, you know what, Bill? I said, what? when it's raining like this and the sun is shining, that means the devil is beating his wife with a frying pan. I said, yeah. He said, you can hear it. And I tried to hear it. In fact, I thought I heard it after it was suggested to me. You know, I thought I heard that. He said, I said, how do I really hear it? He said, you have to stick a needle in the ground and put your ear to it. I know it was stupid. I went in the house and got my mother's sewing needles, and I stuck it in the ground, and I put my ear to the needle, and I could swear I heard him whamming on his wife, the devil. I stayed out there and got quite wet. And I really, afterwards, I thought I really heard it. And I told people about it. I heard the devil beating his wife with a frying pan. It was all kind of crazy little stuff like that that I had an imagination for. And I tended to have to prove to myself that these things actually happen. I didn't go to school until I was 7 years old. I would hear the kindergarten on the other street, hear the bell ring in the afternoon, and I asked, why can't I go to kindergarten? And my mother said, you're too little. I don't know what that meant. I said, well, but I want to go. They said, you don't need to go. We'll teach you at home. So they did. They homeschooled me, bought me books. I was reading before I ever started school. I was doing numbers and all that kind of stuff before I ever went to school. And what the result of that was, when I did go to school when I was 7 years old, and before the year was up, they boosted my grade. They put me in the third grade, which was okay because I was very bored in the first grade. I know this stuff. And so they asked my mother, is it okay if we skip William to the third grade? She said yes. I did okay, but everybody in the class, my class was a giant. They were so much bigger than me, you know. They were real third graders. I was a first grader. And I remember there were two boys who drew very well. Then it was heroes, you know. And the heroes of that day was, of course, Superman, Batman, and some of the other men who, you know, Flash Gordon. And it was good to get with them and draw. Both of them were better than me. I was drawing some kind of resemblance to Superman. They were drawing, and they had the muscles and all that, and that impressed me. So that meant I had to draw at home and to keep up with them, or to learn how do they do that. And I wouldn't dare ask them. Many times, I'd go to my mother and said, Mom, I need paper. See, I didn't have those little kitty writing pads. I had thin paper. She said, well, why do you need paper? I said, well, I've used it all up. She said, I just bought you several packs of paper, maybe less than a month ago. Bring me your notebook. And when she get the notebook, she said, no wonder, you have a drawing on every other page. I said, yeah, we draw in school a lot. One thing about being able to draw in school, I don't think I was a celebrity, but I felt pretty good about it. Because all the teachers, when it came to holidays, especially Christmas, and they wanted somebody to come in their room and draw them turkeys on the wall. And I drew so many Santa Clauses. I could really draw Santa Claus up and down in my mind. I mean, it didn't need anything to go on. But what happened was, they sent for you out of your class and want you to draw for them on the boards, you know. That was pretty cool, you know, and I felt pretty cool about that. I got better by drawing in company with my buddies. Yeah, but I never let them know that I was really worried that they could draw so much better than me. So that in itself pushed me to keep drawing. I tell kids now, if you're going to, you want to be an artist, you have to keep it up. And there was always time. There was never time of any length that I wasn't drawing, no matter what I was. You know, I went to the Army, went to Germany. I drew all 4 years because when they came around for inspection, and I have drawings on the wall, and they'll ask, "Did you do that, Cooper?" "Yes, sir." "Well, they want to see you in the office." I said, "Oh, what have I done? I'm not supposed to put up drawings?" "Okay." So I go to the office, and they say, "You have drawings on your wall." I said, "Yes, sir, I do. How would you like to draw for the Army?" I said, "What?" "Yes. Now, I know it might be a little boring, because all we want is graphs, you know, not any real thought-out work like you do." I said, "Oh, I wouldn't mind that. You know, just shots and graphs." But it came to be much more than that when I was in the service. This is to say that I always had a connection with drawing. I didn't dream. Well, I really didn't dream I'd do that when they sent me on the journey. I was taught to be a clerk, supply clerk. Boring. Yeah. But I went into heavy auto maintenance, and I had to hand out parts to heavy trucks when they needed them, and turn them in and give them a good one, repaired one, you know, and I just sit there until somebody come and said, "I needed whatever they wanted." Let me see what I used to do. All kinds of truck parts. But anyway, that meant I didn't have to do that anymore. And that was cool. And what happened is, when the young man up in, what did they call it then? Up in headquarters, I wasn't in headquarters. I was just a regular soldier. But I'm trying to think of what they call that part. The big, been a while. Anyway. But anyway.
Can I ask what years you were in the military? What years were you in the military?
65 to 70, 65 to 69. Yeah. It's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But anyway. Battalion headquarters, anyway, I'm sorry. There was an artist there. He was a battalion artist. But when his time was up, they asked me if I wanted to go and become a battalion artist, and I said yes. So the rest of the time, I was in battalion drawing. And you draw for colonels and majors. He said, "You know, the Army works on paper. You know, we have the general coming to our complex. He's not going to walk around this thing looking to see what's going on and if things are being done right. We have to be able to open a big book and say, 'Sir, this is what's happening,' blah, blah, blah." That's what I had to do. And they were always asking me to do some other things that they needed. You know, like, we need a chart. Okay. We want this chart to demonstrate to us, if we want to know where a man is at any given time, we want to be able to look at the chart and tell us where he is. Whether he's on furlough, if he went to sick bay, if he went to eat, we want to know. So I kind of made up a chart with, you know, stick pens and all different colors, with everybody's name on it, and any destination in that part where I was in Germany at that time, where he could possibly be, put it on the wall. And Sergeant Smith, he had to, anytime somebody, they have to go through the orderly room, no matter where you're going. And he goes in, and Sergeant Smith take his stick pen and stick it where he went. He come back. I thought that was fun, you know. But I'm just saying, I always had a connection with drawing, even when I didn't think I was. Because I was getting ready to ask for a transfer to Georgia to be a MP, military police. I didn't know nothing else to do. But that happened.
How would you say the transition went for you from art being something that was always present, but, you know, sort of in the background maybe at points, to becoming the focus of your career?
Well, I always wanted to draw. I can't say I wanted to be an artist, because one time I thought I was going to be a baseball player. But I had so many chances to draw that it became something that I was doing most of the time, and I liked it. You know, it came from just casual drawing to a wannabe. And I said, whenever I finish high school, I'm going to major in art, which I did. But I didn't always know I wanted to be an artist. I didn't know what it meant to be an artist, mm-hmm. You know. But along the way, I was influenced by people, kind of all, not purposely, but from seeing them do artwork. I remember I was about 12 years old, and I was drawing. And I lived in the projects. So there was a young man moved into an apartment across from where I lived. And one day, it was in the summertime, I saw this man painting outside, and I had to see what he was doing. Wow, because I was trying myself. But I made sure that I didn't disturb him. I've never even asked him his name or nothing. And I stood out there and watched this man paint on the grass. I said, I wish I could do that. I'm going to do that. Well, who's going to teach me to do that? Nobody. I didn't know anybody else who drew or who painted. But what I did, I saved up enough money. I would cut grass in a project and wash windows until I get enough money to buy a small set and a board canvas. And I sequestered myself upstairs with the door closed. I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing. And I painted a woman. Something I had in my head that I had seen in a magazine maybe or somewhere. But I didn't have a picture. I just knew she had on a scarf and headdress. And I painted it. I painted it and I tore it up right after I painted it. It was horrible. I said, I'll never try this again. Oh boy. I didn't show it to anybody, but I tore it up. I didn't want anybody to see it again. I thought I would never try. But let me say, just tell you something, how I really got started before this. Because they didn't let me go to school, they had to find something for me to do that would satisfy me. And my grandmother, who I'd never known to be an artist, she could make a draw ahead, I think it from the comic strip, of a woman beside you. And she said, okay, how would you like to draw? I said, what's drawing? She said, this is draw pictures. Here, draw this lady. I drew that lady, and that was it. I was hooked. This was when I was just 7 years old. No, I wasn't seven. I was seven, I started school. But that's the only, let's say, direction I've ever been given to go or to emulate. My grandmother, I'd never seen her draw anything since then. And what helped that was the fact that whatever I would draw after that, my mother would hang it on the wall. I said, you can't be kidding. You think this is good? But it made me feel good. And my first real painting, I thought, was my oil paintings. I did a copy of a painting called Night Toilers. I believe that was Winslow Homer. And she framed it and put it on the living room wall. And I was really proud of that, you know. And from that time on, I was serious about drawing and painting. Not being an artist, just drawing and painting, because I loved it, you know. So when I did graduate from elementary school, went to high school. High school was the first school that I would have ever gone to, first time I ever had an art teacher. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy to hear that. She was a very good art teacher, I guess she was. It kept me having my mind on drawing and all that kind of stuff. And I was still drawing for teachers even in high school, but I was a little better. Mm-hmm. And my teacher called me up to a desk one time, and she says, show me what you're doing. And we did, I had done a wall William, you're afraid of hands, huh? I said, what do you mean? She said, I like your drawings, but every drawing you get, give me, the person had their hands in their pockets. I said, yes, ma'am, I guess I am. I was afraid of hands because they were really hard to do. So she said, tell you what you do. Not now, but anytime you're sitting around, if you don't have someone to model a hand for you, use your own hand and do it from all different angles. And I did that, and I became quite efficient at painting hands. that was in high school.
Was she the one who helped you come back to trying painting again?
Was she the one? Oh, yes, because before then I had no instructions. Mm-hmm. Had never had instructions how to do it or, you know, you should do it. Mm-hmm. They were just pacifying me when I was 5 and 6 because I wanted to go to kindergarten. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let me go to kindergarten, but they didn't know it. But they did the right thing when my grandmother said, draw this. It was somebody from the funny papers. I don't know if you ever heard of Mag and Jigs.
You probably won't.
No, you probably haven't. But that must have been one of her favorite cartoons because it did look like Miss Jigs. And I would draw it, and I don't know what I drew after that. That was a real turning point, if you want to call it, that sticks out in my mind because it was the first time I ever drew anything. And so it kept going through my life, through high school, through the Army, through college, you know.
Tell me where you went to college and what you went to college for.
Well, I'm from Alabama. Birmingham. You ever heard of Birmingham?
Oh, yes.
In high school in Birmingham, I majored in art then, but I didn't go to school there. I went to school in Montgomery, the capital of Alabama. And the reason I got in school then is that I was in the oratorical contest for speaking, and I won first prize.
In high school, yeah.
And that was something the school did was so proud, you know. And I won the oratorical contest, but I didn't win a lot. I won $50 and a 1 year scholarship to go there. Well, needless to say, my parents couldn't send me to college. So when I became a sophomore, I wasn't getting any money. I did work in the library before I left Alabama State. And it was such a small amount of money that I didn't see it anyway. It just went straight to the office to pay whatever I owed. And as a result, Mr. Taylor was in the, what do you call it? What office is that? Not the bursar's office.
Registrar?
He called me in the office and said, Cooper, where's my money? I said, Mr. Taylor, I really don't have it. You told me that last month. I said, well, I don't know. But, you know, I'm in college now, and I know a few words, you know, and I thought I might get away with it. I said, Mr. Taylor, you know, you can't get blood from a turnip. He had a cigar in the corner of his mouth. It started wiggling. He looked up at me and said, yeah, but we can send the turnip home. I said, what I intended to do, if I could have made it through, it was like this time of year. Yeah, I was going to be going back home for the holidays. And I said to myself, well, I don't have any money now, and I'm not going to have any money later on. So I think what I'll do, I'll go home to Birmingham and work over the summer and come back in now. September. Couldn't work out. Couldn't buy a job during that time. No jobs, no nothing. And so I meant I had to go someplace that I could get some employment to go back to school. which I didn't go back to school that year, no. But I kept drawing. Would you like to know how I got to Buffalo?
Yes, I would, but I would, yes. Mm-hmm. I was going to
ask. Do you have a question? Do you have a question?
I'm loving listening to you. It's just, it's you. You are a great orator still. I was wondering, when you went to school at the University of Alabama in Montgomery, did you go for art?
I did.
That was your major?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah. And so I want to know both how you got to Buffalo and when you went into the military. Was that after your first year of college, or was that before?
Well, that was, I went to military after I went to, I was a sophomore and I didn't go back. So I got drafted.
Okay.
They were drafting.
They were still drafting then, so, okay.
Yeah, they were drafting then. I went to the military from here.
Okay, so tell me how you came to Buffalo.
Okay. Summer 1954. They had a Baptist convention. Big thing. North and South. But being in the South at that time, it was hard for the black people to come to the South and get hotels and that kind of thing, accommodations. So I don't know if my dad knew these people. They were from Lackawanna, right? They were there, and we put them up. They stayed with us, you know. Up Will, that's what everybody called them, Up Will. And I was really desperate because nobody, my mother was ill, and my daddy refused to help me go to school. Refused. He said at that time, why don't you go to the Army? All the other boys are doing it. I said, well, Dad, I don't want to go to the Army. I want to go to college. He said, well, I can't help you. I'm not going to help you. I'm just saying that so you know how desperate I was. I beat the pavement all that past summer trying to get a job, anything, janitor, anything. I went to the stores downtown. They didn't let me do. They wouldn't hire me at all. So they were about to go back home. They stayed, I think they stayed a week. Uncle Will and his wife and another minister from Lackawanna. So there was one person I could really count on. That was my grandmother. It was plain one who started me to draw. I could count on her. And I knew she would give me good advice. First thing I did was ask Uncle Will. I said, Uncle Will, you're from Buffalo, right? He said, yeah. And it's Lackawanna. I said, well, are there any jobs up there? He said, oh, yeah, that's been a job. Yeah. I said, yeah, what kind of job? He said, well, I can get you a job at Bethlehem Steel. I said, oh, wow. So I don't know now, do I? Just asking if I can go up there with nothing. So I went and told my grandmother about it. I said, what do you think? She said, I think you should go. I really think you should go. I said, but I don't have any money. She said, but don't worry about that. Just do it. I learned everything I know today, or think I know, I will ever know, my grandmother taught me. She was such a wise woman. Oh, Lord, she was.
What was her name?
Hmm?
What was her name?
Eliza.
Eliza.
We called her Eliza. And we all called her Mama. Mama said, and here, when you get ready to go, come and see me. But in the meantime, I had to ask Uncle Will, what about it? But can I go back with you? He said, oh, sure, you can go. So I put my little, whatever I had, one change of clothes in a bag. And when they got ready to come back to Buffalo, they drove down in the Cadillac. They were preachers in a big Cadillac. And I went and told my grandmother and told Mom, I said, Mom, I'm going. I didn't bother my mother with it. I tried my best to keep my mother out of all this with my dad because she was sick. And I didn't want to make her worse. And she said, come back when he gets ready to go. I went back. She took $20 bills. In my shirt pocket. So So when we arrived at Lackawanna, I thought it was in Buffalo. Then I found out the next day we weren't in Buffalo, but Buffalo is just over the hill. I had $20, and I soon got a job at a hospital. You know, it wasn't paying much at all, but I had to have something. I stayed in Lackawanna for 9 months, and then I took off to Buffalo, where I was still working at Bethlehem, and where I was drafted from Buffalo. Yeah, that's how that went. Of course, I never went back to Lackawanna. Well, Uncle Will treated me real bad, so, you know, he got me in debt before I wanted to be in debt. So we had basically the same name, William. Yeah. And he introduced me to the people at the jewelry store so I could get what I needed, if I needed a watch or something like that. He pushed me into buying a car. I was making so little money. But I found out later he had me buy the car because he couldn't buy one. He had been in a grave accident where people were killed, so he couldn't drive at all. So he never bought another car, so he used my car all the time. And at the hospital that I worked at, I got to know some of the people that knew him. And she just told me some of the secrets about him. He had another girlfriend, and he was buying jewelry for her on my account. When they called me in, I had to explain, it's not for me. It's Uncle Will, that's what I'm called. But anyway, that was just one of the things that reason I had to get out of Lackawanna. Yeah. I came over here, and then I was working at Bethlehem so I could have an apartment. I got an apartment, and soon, I don't know how soon was that, I went back to finish school. They sent me from Alabama State almost all of my credits.
That's great.
That was good, you know. And I majored in art at the University of Buffalo. And it was cool. I finally finished. And my advisor told me, you know, Bill, it's going to be hard. You only have a bachelor's in art. Maybe you should think in terms of taking credit to be a certified teacher. And I appreciated that. And I did. And I ended up, when I graduated, going right into teaching art. I taught art for about 12 years in the public school system. Yeah, but I was having so much trouble with City Hall. You know. They didn't agree with my methods of teaching art, and they didn't care. Mm-hmm. They didn't know anything about art.
Is it because you weren't very standardized, or you were really being very creative? And
I wanted to be creative with the kids, and they wouldn't let me.
What years were you teaching in the public school system?
From 76 to for 12 years.
Yeah,
so 86.
89?
88, something like that. So I taught, and it was very well. But then I don't want permission. It would be a nice day. And it was out the window, the grass. I said, kids, how would you like to go out and we draw things on this outside on the grass? Oh, yes, we'd love to do that. And I said, well, I have to get permission to take me out. Oh, no, Mr. Cooper, we can't do that. We're responsible for the kids. I said, yeah, I'm not going to take them off the campus. Just right outside. No, we can't do that. They stifled anything I wanted to do. And as always said, well, City Hall wouldn't allow us to do that. You know? I got a lot of static from the men teachers because I was always having the kids to do interesting things. And therefore, they liked me. They liked me. And I kept them doing nice things. They wanted me to be there. What do you call the teacher who's helped them with their when they graduate.
Advisor?
Yes, and I had to help them too. And they wanted a big thing. You remember that was the time, the song of Up and Away in my beautiful balloon.
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that year, I said, let's make balloons.
Really?
We made big, colorful balloons. And we hung them on the stage, I and myself. But the men were going to the principal. See, I was trying to do too much. And she went with them. So I gotta get out of here. Yeah, I was not doing any, you know, most of the teachers, the subject teachers, they didn't care anything about art. If kids got a little unruly, they said, all right, settle down, go to art. That's why you do that. Well, the teachers told us we can come in and have fun. I said, we can have fun, but we can have fun.
Yeah.
I remember they were breakdancing at the time. Kids loved to breakdance. Mm-hmm. They put down a piece of cardboard and dance on it. So they come in, jumping up and down, hold it. Let's clear this long two tables and push them together. Now, anybody who want to dance, you get up on the table for the first 5 minutes. After that, you're going to have art. And they loved that. Mm-hmm. Teachers went wild. So my superintendent, he did not like me. He told me I was too easy. I said, well, that's my style. So, yeah, but you're just too easy. Why is he talking? I said, I let him talk. This is art. I want them to discuss what they're doing with each other. You know? No, no. They don't do that. No, you can have them talking. I said, man, I know I can't stay here. I wanted to make a difference in this for the kids. But I wasn't allowed to make a difference, you know? So I came out and I started working for Neighborhood Art Center.
Which one?
Well, it was a Maston Community Workshop. It doesn't exist anymore because they built up housing at the time. And I was making probably, if half, of what I was making in steel plant. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, William, you're crazy to quit this job. I said, why? You're making your salary is next to the foreman's. Why would you do that? I said, this is not how I came here. I don't want to do this. See, I took an examination. They put a, this is how it was. Bethlehem built or had built in Pennsylvania a large automated machine. It was almost a block long. Yeah. And all you had to do was, you know, they said, this is what you're going to be running, Bill. I said, when? He said, you'll be doing this in your sleep within a week. And in a week, I was. So that was it had nothing to do with seniority. It was I was second on the test. First on the test. And another brother, but he was second. So I worked today's shift on the machine, and he worked the night shift. And I had to make two reports a day and that kind of thing. But anyway, that meant I was making pretty good, and it was a job that was a whole lot of the other guys wanted. Mm-hmm. And hear me say, I'm leaving here. Mm-hmm. An older man asked me one day, she said, Bill, what are you doing here? I said, what do you mean? I'm trying to make a living. You don't belong here. I said, yeah. He said, look at me, I'm stuck. And I can't go anywhere. You can. So I was thinking about that. He said, you know what? You work hard, I know you do. You are making money for this big company. And if you're gonna work this hard for Bethlehem Steel, think of what you'd do if you had your home. Okay, I'm gone, yeah. I started out, what was the next art job I had? Well, see, I was a sign painter too, you know. Mm-hmm. I learned sign painting all summer. I made money that I could not have made in a job. Flex Loom sign on Main Street asked me if I'd like to work for them. Come on up, let's talk. They said, is this your work? Yes. And another sign company offered me a job working for them. I said, no, no, no. Because during in the summer. Well, the thing about it, before I actually quit, I didn't have that automated job. I was just a working laborer.
At Bethlehem Steel?
And when I first went there.
Right.
I was a laborer until I took that exam.
And then did you have the sign job after Bethlehem Steel or before?
Oh, yeah, I always did sign circles. So before that job, I was laid off so much. They laid off guys going and coming, you know. And that's when in the summertime, I would do signs. I got to be pretty good at it. And I really didn't care if they called me back. I went back because I wanted something that was kind of steady, you know.
So can I ask you a little bit about some of your art and community activism? You know, as you went forward, I know you were involved with a number of different arts organizations, including eventually here we are at Buffalo Arts Studio.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk a little bit about some of the other artist groups and organizations you got involved with?
Well, what I did, I tried to create organizations with the artists, but that didn't work. You know, the artists weren't ready to be organized. You know, they just thought all you're going to do is paint and do that and that kind of thing. When you're organized, you have to be able to at least buy stamps when you want. And then in those days, there were grants that was available for artists, you know, when you're there. And when they were giving out grants, they didn't just go out and come in your neighborhood and say, who's an artist in this neighborhood? You had to have some kind of organization for them to even consider you. Well, when I remember once I helped to put together an organization, and I said, now we need to do something to make money. Not a lot of money, but for the office things we're going to need. Nobody saw that. Nobody wanted to do that. And I really did it when I say, be nice to have our building. What? I said, yes, a building that's ours. We can do whatever we want with it. Well, that fell right through. And I was arrested one time, activism. Yeah, but I didn't stay in jail long. They say I was trying to start a riot. You know, the police said I was. And I really wasn't, but they said. And some of the cops that I knew when we went to court said they didn't know me. I saw the cops and I said, I know you're in a rouse, and they know they didn't know. But I talked back to the cop. And he said I was it starting a riot or causing a riot to be, you know. I was doing some activism for a cop, you know, there and there. I don't have a record. Is that what you want to know?
Yeah, I recalled in your... Actually, hold on, let me grab... I have it written on a piece of paper, and it might be what you're talking about. But there was an arts organization you were involved with from the 70s. Mm-hmm. The Afrocentric Artists Collective. And
It was pretty... That was a good collective. Artists moved away, and some just dropped out. It's been very hard to work with other artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very hard. We start out real gung-ho. When you see there are more things you must do, some things you have to be responsible for if you want to be an artist. And some of them include some money. I remember once Dr. King was in town, downtown at the City Hall, and they were having a parade. And I don't know which one of those organizations we had started then, but we started, and I had a shop at Main and Utica upstairs, Cooper's Gallery Workshop. So we worked out of there, and we were trying to figure out how we could make some money there. So I said, well, I know silk screening, and suppose we did portraits of Dr. King and doing the rallies downtown. Silk screen, we might be able to sell some. So they said, fine. But when I called the meeting to talk about let's work, nobody had time to do it. So I ended up staying up all night of printing maybe, I don't know, people 100 silver screens for the next day, and maybe two people came and took some to go down there. One guy was, he was from Ghana, West Africa. He said he was afraid to be out there. They might send him back or something like that. And the others just didn't show up. So I had to take as many as I could and go down with two people we had and distribute these things. Of course, we didn't make a lot of money doing that. But nobody was interested in doing that kind of thing, you know. And that's why I know for all, I never had good luck with them. But so what happens when you when it's like that, these organizations fall apart. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to be a part of an organization in Rochester even now, but they aren't doing anything. They're so inactive, you know.
I like to say, you know, working in groups, especially with groups of artists, is like herding cats. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you can't herd cats. Everybody's going to do their own thing.
Yeah, they do. I happen to know that. I have two.
You have two what?
You say cats?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have two.
Yeah, and you can't tell them what to do. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about your experiences here with Buffalo Art Studio, you know, because you've been affiliated with them for how many years now?
Oh, 16 years.
16 years, at least, yeah. And do you find this is...
Well, Buffalo Art Studios offer me what I need to be an artist. See, what happened, let me say this first. I used to travel in Africa, most all of West Africa and some of East Africa. And I would get artifacts, paintings, clothing, dresses, and masks, anything they were making over there, and bring it here. Because I had a boutique for about, 10 years. I moved around a little bit, and that's why I sold my artists at artifacts, you know. So what happened, I have stenosis. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of it?
No.
Spinal stenosis. And I've had two back operations. One maybe was okay, but I shouldn't have gotten the second. Because after the first one, I could still walk, but I was in pain. And I got talked into, the doctor said I should have a second one. And they pretty much cured the pain, but I can't walk. Mm-hmm. And I've had to, as anybody else would do, I guess, find ways to do what I always done, except walk. You know, had to adapt to a lot of things, keep painting. Well, I was running my boutiques. In fact, I had to a point where if I wanted to, I could franchise them. They were all like, part of it was selling artifacts and the other part was framing artwork and prints and stuff like that, you know. But it got to a point where I couldn't physically do it. So my wife suggested, said, you know, you've always wanted to just paint. Why don't you do that now? Because I'm retired. I said, yeah, but I like going to Africa. And I always had a reason to go to Africa. But I knew I couldn't. See, you don't go to Africa unless you can walk. Mm-hmm. Not take care of business. You got to walk a lot. You don't have to, you know, you need to ride, but you have to walk a lot. I don't take cars with me. So I get to know people in different parts of Africa where they would always help me when I come over. One of the families, they owned, where they get their medical supplies from Germany. He sold medical supplies, that's what I mean. And his nephew sold sewing machines and all that. And they had plenty of transportation, so I could always get around, you know. But I got to a point where after these operations, it just shut me down. And so, as I said, she said, why don't you just paint? Well, I had a couple of studios around. I had friends say, Bill, I have a back room. I'm not using it. You want to use it, blah, blah. And I would use that, too, for... And sometime I just rented thing right on Main Street. I used to have a studio in Maine in Utica, mm-hmm. like I tell you, you know. And I said, well, you're right. That sounds real good. Well, she was for it. And I had just met Joanna. You know Joanna.
Joanna Gillespie, yeah.
Joanna said, Bill, I have a large studio up in the building at 2495 Main Street. Yeah. Why don't you still come by sometime and see what we're doing? I said, okay. Because I had done a lot of work with Joanna. We did murals and screws and parks all over all summer, you know. That's when I was working. Well, anyway, I came up and talked to her about possibly getting space. And I did get a space. Yeah. And I was about to tell you that it gives me what I need, somewhere to work. Somewhere, most of the time it's quiet. Nobody bothers me. And I'm on my own, you know, go and come when I get ready. You know, I never had any problem. But that's why I've been here such a long time, because all I wanted was a place to work, to paint. And this has been it. And I'm still here. I don't know what would make me go someplace else, because what I want to do is paint, and that's what I'm doing. You know, I could say, well, I think I'm tired of being here. Why am I tired of being here? All I want to do when I come here is paint and go home, you know.
Can we talk about your painting a little bit? I'd like to talk to you about why you create what you create.
Oh, that's kind of hard.
I know.
But anyway, I create, really, out of life, my own life experiences. I have no particular thing that I like to create about. It's anything. And if it impresses me, you know, and I have a feeling for it, I have to have a feeling for something I did, or I can't do well at it. So when I get something that comes in my mind, I think about it, and if I like it well enough and like to create about this thing. See, my thing is, I don't want to just put an object up and paint it. I want to paint how I feel about that object. You know, what does that bring in my heart? That's what I paint. You know, I don't want to paint scenery. I don't go out and paint scenery. I create everything I do. I don't use models. But I can draw or paint anything that I can conceive in my mind. I can do. I don't need props. I create my props. I create everything. And if it's a situation that I feel good about it. Now you take, I did this woman series right here. I did 10 of those. I think the first part of the year, I don't know what year that was, I decided to do a series of women. And the idea is that I've always wondered, and I think other men wonder too, but I don't know that. It's been interesting to say, what does women think about when they're alone? I said, not just when they go in the house and close the door. When they are totally alone, nobody's interrupting them. Do you want to just walk around the house and be free? Or what do you ask her to think about? Well, that was my thing. That's what I want to know. Because I want to create women that would signify, that would was about what I'm asking the question. So I said, maybe it might help to ask the women, what do you think about when you... And they give me some kind of flip answer. Not, I knew they weren't going to tell me, and it wouldn't have made any difference anyway, because I was going to decide myself what they think about. So I said I was going to do 10 in different poses and let others wonder what's on her mind. One lady was funny. She said, we cry a lot. I said, really? No, I said, you're kidding. Yeah, we do. When we're alone. And I didn't really need to know. I wanted to be, it was just speculative. You know, I want to paint about it. And I'm going to paint these women in a way that I think they would look.
It's interesting to hear you talking about this, because this makes me think about what you were saying at the beginning about your desire as a child to have answers to questions, even if you're making the answers up.
Make it up.
You know? And it's cool to see that continue.
Because I'm a stickler for creativity. I definitely am.
Yeah.
When I was teaching school, I found it difficult to really teach creativity, because it was a long time before I understood it. And I come I came to understand what it means. I had a little class, I think they might have been third grade, fourth graders. I said, do you know how to create? No, Mr. Cooper, I don't know how to create. I said, I'm going to give you an idea how to create. Tell you what, close your eyes. Everybody close eyes. I said, okay, what do you see? Nothing. I said, I want you to imagine an elephant. He said, okay, I have an elephant. I said, is he big? Yeah, he's big. What color is he? He's gray. Why? Because elephants are gray. I said, no, I want you to invent your own elephant. It doesn't have to, he doesn't have to be gray, right? That's true. I said, well, you see him standing by a tree? Yeah, I see him. I said, well, there's a big elephant standing by a tree. What color is the tree? Brown. I said, no, you make up this tree. You create your own tree. You're going to invent an elephant. He's not yours if you don't invent him. Anybody can draw an elephant for the way he looks in nature. Oh, I said, now, what color is he? I said, can he be a polka dot? Yeah, he's a polka dot. And can the tree be blue? Yeah, it's good, it could be blue. I said, no, okay. Look up in your mind, look up at the clouds. What do you see? I see clouds, white. What color are they? They're white. I let them get away with that. Are they moving? Yes. Now, I want you to take your big polka dot colored elephant and sit him on top of the cloud. Yeah, in your own mind. So they said, yes. Now you have a big polka dot colored elephant floating across the sky of a cloud. Can you see him?
Yes, I see him.
I said, well, you just created that elephant. I hope that shows them something. But I think the older they get, the more they understand about creativity. Mm-hmm. If it's not creative, it's not art. I don't care what anybody says. You know, even if it's not creative, it is not art.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the other different series you've done in your career? I know you've done a lot of murals as well and some commissions and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Like I said, I'll paint about anything. I've done some commissions. I've done some things way back when Dr. King was still alive. I had a mural of Dr. King in two libraries here. Yeah.
In Buffalo?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a portrait of Dr. King at the college over here, Catholic College. In the, what's that room? It's right off from me.
You're talking about Canisius?
Hmm?
You're not Canisius?
Wait a minute. Yeah, it's a Canisius. I know the name of the library. All this is a life size. And then I have two paintings in the Buffalo Bio, what do you call it, in the complex down here. I got two paintings in the medical complex.
Oh, okay. Can I ask, when you do portraits, for example, like your portrait of Dr. King, is it in the really exuberant, colorful style that we see here in your studio, or is it more representational?
It's more representation. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why. Sometimes I have to let that happen. Because when someone asks, most times when they ask for something, they have an idea of what they want to be done. And if it's not that way, in a sense, I didn't really truthfully do it in a portrait of Dr. King. I tell you what, in the Martin Luther King Park, there's a, I don't call it a statue, I call it a representation of Dr. King. Well, the people in the community had been looking forward to that. I didn't do this. And they didn't know what it was going to look like until the day they unveiled it. And when they finally unveiled it, you could hear a sigh go all over the park. That's not Dr. King. It was not a true representation of Dr. King. and until this day, they still don't accept it. Actually, it's a head, a large head, from an artist who has done a lot of heads, like in Egypt, big head of Dr. King. And it's up on a pedestal, not a, like a wall, but they will never accept that. And when you do have something like that, the community is paying for it. So sometimes you have to give them what they want. You know, if I was doing it for myself, offering it up for pay or not, I would do it in my own style. I really want. But this has been like over 20 years, and they never accepted Dr. King. Mm-hmm. But what it is
it's a representation.
That rental.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what it is, a representation of him, hit the head part. You know, I guess it's had to do with his wisdom and all that, and the head, this artist did heads. But sometime I do that. I hate to do that. I hate to have to follow their vision of what it should be. Mm-hmm. Now, if you tell me you can do it your way, I've done paintings for people, and I said, well, now, you know how I paint. Oh, yes, I know how you paint. Just do it in your style. We want it in your style. Then I find I'm freer to do that, you know?
So tell me a little bit how you would describe your style. I want to hear it from you.
Oh, my style?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to be funny right now.
Be funny.
If you were a poet, are you a poet?
Not really, no.
And you read some lines of your poetry or a whole verse to a number of people, right? Would you want to then turn around and explain what you just read?
That's true.
You can do that. Yeah. But I just want.
No, you can. We don't have to do it like
no,
that.
No, I'm going to do it.
Okay, I can ask you more questions about it. I can ask you questions about
it. Why? Ask me a question.
Okay, I'll ask you some questions.
Okay.
So I want to ask you about your use of design in your works, you know.
I can tell you that.
Yeah, let's talk about design.
The times I spent, I was painting, you know, some kind of way or the other, before I started going to Africa. And I was very much impressed by African art of all kinds. And I was really got hooked on the art of Senegal. And I did my own kind of study of it. What did it look like? It looked. But what it is, what I needed to understand, and I think I already did understand it when I saw it, it's representation. And many writers who write about African art, when they see a short woman with a large stomach and a big head, and they would assume or they would say that this person could not render them anatomically correct. And that's not it. That's abstract. You talk about abstract. They were the creators of abstract. That means either that the brain, which they consider the main part of the body, is where everything happened, and it is. So when they do a big head, it's not because they can't do a smaller head that look more lifelike. It serves their purpose to do it like that. You know? And many times when writers write about art of Africa, they think it's just, they call it primitive, but it's really not primitive. They're not primitive in the sense that it was the one of the first and all that. That would be okay. But it represents some feature about that character, about that strength, that tells you who they are. And I believe this too. I'm just going to throw this in. It's hard to really appreciate an artist's work if you don't know anything about the artist.
I agree.
That's right. This is where I come from. Now, I said, I was already doing understanding about some of the things of the Senegalese art. But I got to know artists over there, and I got to paint with some of the artists over there. And I realized that this is what I want to be influenced by. I might tell you this. I might say my work is influenced by Miles Davis, the way he plays the music, because it's all the same to me. The registers that he does, the highs and lows, I like the way he does that. That's what happens. I try to get some of that in my pen. And most of all, I'm also influenced, I'm highly influenced by the music. I can't paint without music. That's why I got all this contraption here. So I can hear music and learn and play some of it. Yeah. But that's when I come to understand that what abstraction was, then I'll have my own brand of abstract. You know, I'll do this myself. I like to elongate my figures. That's one thing I like to do. But sometimes I start painting, start drawing, and I forget the fact that I'm going to elongate it. Now it's going to run off the canvas. I have to be mindful of that, you know. And color. I love color, and I didn't get that from the Africans. I always liked color. But then they use a lot of color. And then that means that I was more than happy to use color. Now let me say this. When I first started painting in colors, I didn't know how to do it. I was afraid of color. After the first two colors, I'm saying, what do I do? Just close my eyes and paint this? No. Every color I use in any painting you see was carefully chosen. Where you see the color, it was chosen to go there. Because I've made mistakes and put a color in one part of my painting, and I go back and I have to take it out and put another color there that was more suitable for what I'm trying to say. So, you know, you see abstracts come in so many different forms. When a parent say, oh, my kid can do that, they can. Because kids are artists. It's just that I tell people with little kids, instead of, you don't want them to write on the wall, right? So you give them something big to write with. Give little kids a big pencil so they can hold it. And let them make lines wherever they are going to go. So what happened? They discover that when I do this, I see a line. And I do this, and I see another line. And I like this. So soon, in their development, they realize, if I can make this line, I can make it go where I want it to go. You know? Just a big pencil. And, of course, as they become older, cognitively, they start then deciding what they want this line to look like, to say. So they start forming, I guess, pictures and things that we see. They might be kind of crude, but they're forming things that look like something. And when they get older, they really, you know, say, okay, I know how to draw a chicken, or I can do this, and I can make real-life forms. But I think if you let them do that, they discover for themselves that they can make those lines look like something. And they discover themselves, you know. I'm sure I did that when I was a little kid. I remember doing that, though. Mom had me draw it so soon, you know. Yeah. And, you know, I learned a lot from African art because I studied it on my own, too, but when I actually went there and saw it being made so much, I was just overwhelmed with it. But I realized all they were doing was, well, not all they were doing, I don't trivialize it, but they were taking form and making the form have meaning. I do the same thing here, I take form and make it think that. I don't know, I had so much in college, in both colleges that I went to, I had so much anatomy, drawing models that just made me sick. At one time I was having anatomy and physiology and science, and then go right from there to art class, and we got another model. So I figured I want my model to look like what I want it to be. If she's deformed, okay, let me make her deformed, but she's not. You know, so I don't have to have a person standing in front of me and all that kind of thing. And that's good. I don't use props, like I said before. If I knew it was a prop, I'd make it up out of my head. Because I can draw anything I can see, anything, and then things I can't see. I sometimes get ideas out of songs, and I create something from titles of songs. What does that mean to you? Okay. And they turn out, they don't always, like for instance, I don't always know what it's going to look like. Sometimes I surprise myself. And sometimes, like, my wife will know that I'm painting. She said, how's the painting coming, Bill? I said, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I don't know if I like it. So what are you going to do? I'm going to keep working on it and see if I start to like it. Maybe I call her back and say, guess what? I like this. It's going to be something. You know? And that's where creativity comes in. You create, you make it be what you want it to be and how you want it. And if it's not like you think you want it, it scares you. You don't want to do it. Yeah. And now what I hate, though, I hate to keep artwork that I don't like that I did. I take that gesso and rip it out in a minute. Yeah. I did a painting once called Who Am I? And everybody in the family liked it, but I didn't like it. I don't know why I went on and finished it. And my little son said, Dad, I know who that is, but I paint something over it already. That's Who Am I? I said, no, it's not. Yes, it is. I know it is. I remember that canvas. So you still think it's under there? Well, I guess it is under there. But I take gesso and my kids are very used to art, and they're very used to seeing me paint women. And because one time I was a portrait painter. I don't like to paint them anymore because there's no freedom in it, you know. And I don't do it because people are looking at it and want it to be the way they want it to look. And I know there's more to a portrait than just what a camera can do, you know. And so I don't do portraits unless it's a caricature or something like that. I've really made much of my living painting portraits. When I was in the service, though, it was really nice. Guy come to me and said, Bill, look at here, he showed me his girlfriend picture. Can you paint that? Yeah, I can paint it. It might be Thursday or Friday. I say, come back Monday, $35. And I did so many portraits. I made one big mistake. You know, we have to keep our rifles and stuff pretty much shined up, the wooden part. You know, we had linseed oil. And I felt like, why should I buy linseed oil? And we got it. I used to paint a picture in oils, because I love oils. In fact, I don't even know how to paint watercolor. I want to take a watercolor course. But anyway, I painted, but I used linseed oil to make it spread. And I had guys bringing me their pictures back and say, it's yellow. What did happen? And I had to think about it. I said, no, it's the linseed oil. But see, the linseed oil we use in art is refined. And thought I was really getting away with something. And I had to go over the painting again. But, you know, they don't make much money in the army or in the armed forces. Anyway, I need to tell you about that. I would do assignments for the colonels up in headquarters. And usually they were the big shots, you know, the colonels. And I never worked for a general. But anyway, they would bring something to me and say, this is what we need. Can you do it? And I looked at it and I said, piece of cake. But I wouldn't tell them piece of cake. I said, when do you need it, sir? 2 weeks. I said, yeah, I can get that for you. And I know I can do it in 1 week. So all that time is my time. because I didn't have to worry about not having it. Now, when you have it in 2 weeks, they are very grateful. Mm-hmm. Now, you know what one of the most valuable things to me in the service, besides money, which is very valuable?
Time.
Yeah. Time off. Yeah. So that meant I had always wanted to see parts of Europe, no matter where I was. So I would save my money and whatever I could save. And I always had time to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make sense if you got time and don't have any money. So they kept me with time, and I did my best to save money. And one way I saved money was selling cigarettes. They want American cigarettes. Everybody want American cigarettes. I remember once they asked me for cigarettes off, and I said, why don't I just buy a pack of their cigarettes? And when they ask me for a cigarette, I give it to them. They look at you, I don't want this. I want Lucky Strike. So, okay. But anyway, cigarettes in the army was rationed then. So you got a ration car. Now see, I don't remember how many cartons you could get for, like 12 cartons or whatever. But there was a lot of guys that came in that didn't smoke. But we knew they had ration cars. So we'll make a deal with them. Let me have it, I'll buy them, or you give them to me, because you don't smoke anyway. And I have all these ration cars. And we go and buy, me and my buddy, we go and buy so many cigarettes. And you don't sell cigarettes on the street because they have what they call the CID. They would get you. But you have if you can trust a certain place you could go to. Like friends I had, German friends say, Bill, I know someone who wants some American cigarettes. I said, well, who are they? Tell me where they are. You trust them? Yeah, we trust them. And they would give us names of people who want them. And we, every once a month, we take like 30 or 40 cartons of cigarettes. And one guy had I hope the CID don't hear this. One guy had a service station, so we used to back up in his service station and dump them. But otherwise, we wouldn't have any, you know what, another thing would have been good. There were some guys who were able to lend money, mm-hmm. and they did it. Then it was a quarter of a dollar.
Yeah.
And so we had guys who could send home and ask for $500 and get it, and they lend the $500 out. Then they stand on payday. They stand at the end of the line with your name, and you can't get away with it, and you don't want to. Because you're going to need some money sometime during that month. In most cases, soldiers were broke by midweek.
Yeah.
And they go.
I want to ask you a few more questions about your art. I guess what I wanted to ask you is, when you make these works, do you hope to achieve anything with your art? You know, or what is your thought process as you make these works? You know, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I like to sell my work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like to sell my work, and there's a lot of pride in being able to sell your work, because artwork is not the easiest thing to support, to sell. And usually when an artist sells his work, he's always underselling himself. But that's one reason why I like to sell my work. And I get better. The more it gives me, I always say, I like this painting here. But if someone want to buy it, I'll sell it, but I hate to get rid of it. But then I told myself, sell it, that means you gotta draw another one, paint another one. Yeah, well, it has a lot. I want to say this. I take a lot of pride in being an artist, whether I make a lot of money or not, because it's a very honorable profession, I think. And it's a lifestyle. It's not just coming up painting. You get into almost like a colony, you know, and everybody is doing the same thing you're doing. And that becomes a lifestyle for you. Not how you paint, but the fact that if you're in a group, it's like doctors, when they get together, they talk about medicine. Artists talk about art. And it is, like I said, an honorable profession. And I'm going to say it like this. Everybody can't do it. And if you're doing something, you're doing it well, and it's something that you need, that's good for your pride and your growth. And anytime you're doing something that's good for your pride, that makes you feel good, it's good for you. I don't brag about nobody can do what I do, because I don't even talk about other artists' work at all. I've been asked, what do you think about this artist? I can't say it because that's what he does. He or she does. So I don't brag about my work, and I don't belittle theirs. But I think it's something to be proud of when you can do something that's creative that cause wonderment in other people, yourself and other people, and things that they want. Or put it like this, it has value. Yeah. There's nothing else I would do. Not something I couldn't get rich on, but art. You know? You understand where I'm coming from? Yeah. It's not just the fact that you're making pictures. You know, you're in a profession. People don't like to look at that. Because I remember when I was working at home, I would get a phone call from people I know, like a buddy of mine. Let's go have a beer, man. I said, I'm painting. Oh, man. Well, you know, oh, come on. Yeah, he doesn't have it. Let me see the value for me, you know. And I have to be true to myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a gimmicky painter. I don't paint gimmicks like magic tricks, illusions. Well, they are illusions, though. They turn out to be illusions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I get lost in what I'm doing. I have to stand back and say, wow, where do I go from here? Okay. Because I have had people to tell me that they get lost in the works. But it's there. If I keep looking at your work, Bill, I start seeing things. I said, yeah, you will. But you can't just... I tell you one reason I paint like that, though. I've been to art exhibitions, and you have people walking around with their wine glasses. Oh, yeah, that's nice. I like the color. Move to the next one. Yeah, I like what he does. Not looking, not really looking at the works, but they think they see it. So I said I was going to force people to look at my work. Because if you walk by with that wine glass and say, oh, he loved color, and you move to the next one, you haven't looked at my work. Those are the turbulent sixties right there. That's what I call it.
This one here?
Mm-hmm. Chaos in the 1960s. But you can't see anything in it unless you stop and think about things that are relative to your understanding, you don't get if you don't look for it. And if you can't find things that are relative to your understanding, what have you done? You know? Some people say, I'll just do. I've had people tell me, you know, yeah, Bill, I could paint. I paint abstract. I said, yeah. Yeah. I can't paint that other stuff. I paint abstract. It's okay. Paint abstract. What you're saying to me, what I paint has no meaning. It just looked like something somebody else has painted. You know? Well, I just hear rock for you. That's in Canada. This exhibition they're having now with Jackson Pollock and other so-called modern artists. I'm going to tell you something, but you probably know it. When you hear people write or read, when people write about African art, they tell you how primitive it is. Where do you think modern art came from?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Most modern artists are looking towards African art for inspiration. Like, that's where it all came from.
Picasso says that this is African art was like the truest form of art and recreation he has seen come from anybody. He would bring masks from Africa. He had a little group he came back to in France, like in the 1890s, and Matisse and other guys who
Braque.
Braque. course, that was his main man.
Yeah.
Well, he started going, Picasso started going in another way and brought hell on to it. I guess it was good for him. He kept doing what they call cubism, because they had some writers saw the works and said, oh, they're little cubes. They
so,
make a good cube.
Yeah.
So they would, and you take an artist like, I won't think of his name. He brought this mask back from West Africa, and they said they passed it around, and they copied it. Well, they used the form and called it something else. They never gave the African artist credit for having done it. But they did a lot of the arts like that, a lot of the art like that. And it became a thing, because see, artists in the late 1890s, especially ones, some of them had been a part of the Renaissance or influenced by the Renaissance, they had come to a point where they are running out a way to paint. For instance, to approach art, they had done the classics, and David, he's just started doing the classics all over again, except he made them big. He made them big, you know? And they said, there must be another way to approach painting. I think, from all I know, Picasso was influenced by the African art, because you got sculpture, which is, you know, multidimensional. You have to see all different sizes of it. So he figured out a way to take a flat surface and draw what was conceived more than one point of view. They have a face straight out and a face on the side. And I'm going to tell you how brazen they were. Will you mind going right over here and bring me? I had a friend who's studying Picasso.
This right here?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. I think he called that the Mademoiselle d'Avignon, Ladies of the Evening.
Yeah.
These are carvings. Now, this one here, he made it look like himself, Picasso. Mm-hmm. But these are just actual masks. He made them rather grotesque. That was not quite. They just took the mask and put it on the body,
yeah,
and tried to make the body fit the mask.
Mm-hmm.
This is still some cubism back here. This was, I think, 1909 or something like that.
So do you find that a lot of your work is, are you inspired in any way by Picasso? Or?
Well, of course, yes, I am.
Yeah.
And I think most artists who paint in these days are inspired somewhat. I don't mind that, but I just going to take umbrage to don't tell the people. Tell when the Africans did this, this was not cool.
No.
Now Picasso can take it, and he doesn't tell you his influence.
Right.
But he just does it, and other artists does it. Matisse and Picasso, they were good friends, but they were rivals.
Yeah. But appropriating, they were appropriating the originals unfairly.
Yeah, they were. And we wouldn't have them if it hadn't been for, what's the lady's name and her brother?
Gertrude Stein?
Gertrude, yeah. Gertrude and her brother, Gertrude Stein, bought most of his and Matisse's work. But see, some of the highest prices that Gertrude paid for them were like $250. And
can you imagine?
I'm sure if she hadn't brought it back, yeah, just said that. To the United States, we wouldn't even have those. Yeah, she brought all that stuff back.
And you wouldn't necessarily know about it to be influenced by it. I mean, granted,
I would not. If she hadn't brought them back.
Yeah.
Because then that was considered the beginning of the modern age. Because, you know, they approached painting very differently from what they had done in the classics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like your take on sort of like paying respects to both modern art and also African art, and really trying to find a way to bring those two back together in a way that's respectful.
I would like that.
Yeah.
I would like that.
It's very respectful.
Yeah. Because you have to see the works they were doing, and they named their works other things. Like, you know, like Brock and quite a few of them that I don't quite recall were doing all the abstract beat, what the critics call little boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you a few more questions.
Okay.
I want to ask you about some of your needs as an artist and some of the needs that you've had throughout your career as mm-hmm. you've been building it, and the needs that you've had from the community. Mm-hmm. What are some ways in which, and we already talked about, you know, your endeavors with community arts organizations, mm-hmm. some of the things that worked and didn't work
right.
with that. We talked about your need for studio space.
Right.
But when it comes to other ways in which the community supports you, what are some examples you've lived through, or maybe some things you needed but never got?
I'll tell you what we needed and never got was recognition by the community. I hope we understand it. Because the community I lived in, most of them didn't have the time to try to appreciate art because they weren't exposed to. We used to go into galleries, and so painting has never been a great thing for the community until nothing that you really needed to know about, because they don't know, they don't have any knowledge of the root of all this. Why should I like painting? Why should I like what you're painting, Bill? It's just a picture, and that's the way they see it. Support from them, like when you have exhibits that they will come out and show, whether they would buy or not. That's what I need in my community, is awareness of art around you. And like I said, I think I try to understand that, because they have a lack of knowledge about art. And it's hard to appreciate something that where your knowledge is limited about it. Why is it important? You know, why should I go to an art opening, much less a gallery? Why would I? Because that's not in my experience. A lot of them haven't had the experience of art. And even when they were in school, it was just something, it was like an afterthought activity that you did. Like the teachers, I told you, said, hey, look, stop jumping up and down in here and acting crazy. Go to art.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's what they told you. Yeah, Mr. Kubrick told us, come to art.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to try to show those kids where coming to art meant more than just playing and jumping up and down
mm-hmm.
and doing that, having no respect for the arts. So what we need is recognition. When I say recognition, not pin medals on us, but pay attention to what we're doing and try to understand why we're doing it. You didn't get it in school, even when you went to college. I know so many college people know zip about art, and they let you know it. I have neighbors and my wife, relatives, don't know what I'm doing. They have no desire to find out. They never come to anything that we do art-wise. And these are people who are active in the community. But it's like child's play that you're doing there. But when I turn around and have my kitchen remodeled, well, you guys got big bucks. And I know what they think. I know Bill didn't do that. Hawaii probably did. But that's not true. I make a decent living selling works. And it's because not only that's good, but I've been doing it so long, and people know me in Buffalo. And there are some of the people who know me like to own my work, and some of them don't. You know, they do. I have an assignment from one of my art clients.
Yes.
I told her, you know, if anybody should come and want to see most of my work, I want to send them to your house. Because she has a collection bigger than anybody that I know. Now, it'd be better than anybody that I know. And She buys my work because she has followed me over the years when I wasn't as sellable as I might be now. And these are people who understand art, why it's desirable, you know, like why diamonds are desirable, yeah. And now there are a lot of people who know why art is desirable, but if you're living in a community that doesn't know, they aren't going to care very much. Like I was telling you, I was told this young man, he was in here, he was in here today. People buy your work, not so much for the work, but because they know you. Yeah, and you have somewhat of a reputation. That's how artists bought, of a reputation. I'm sure there were a lot of very good painters who never had the good fortune of selling much of their work. You know, they were good painters. They didn't get the exposure.
Right.
Yeah.
So related to that question, how did you go about advancing your career in the arts, especially in a situation where you didn't have much support from mm-hmm. your local community?
Right.
But here you are now, you know, very mature in your career,
mm-hmm.
and you are making a respectable living on it and able to
yeah.
do what you love.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, the path you had to navigate with getting gallery shows and making these connections?
Well, it's like I think I've always said that I was always putting my work in the public's eye.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put that work you work in the public. I did murals. People would see me out there doing murals. They didn't rush to me and say, I want a mural done, Bill. But they see you out there painting walls and for institutions, you know. And you make yourself known for what you do.
This concludes the Living Legacy Project interview with William Cooper at the Birchfield Penny Art Center.